Hello, everybody, and welcome to That Millennial Life, a podcast where I talk to different millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. I'm your host, Joe Cole. Today on the podcast, I talk with Mike Mee, who went to the same high school as me, was 2 years ahead of me, so he's been out of college a little longer than I have, and Mike is pursuing filmmaking as a career, so it was great to be able to talk to someone whose interests and career hopes align with mine. We talk about all the experiences he's had as a production assistant on films and TV shows since graduating college, and some projects he's working on and directing. We talk about the Oscars at the end, which happened last night. I'm so happy Leo won, even though I'm recording this the day before and don't know if he actually won. So if he lost, I guess I jinxed him. And now I look like an idiot. But if he won, yeah, buddy. And I know I talked about the whole Oscars diversity issue last week, and I hope people didn't take that as insensitive. Obviously, there's much more to the issue than I communicated. I realize that. I wasn't attempting to pontificate, for lack of a less douchey-sounding word. Does anyone else have that? Where they feel self-conscious about trying to use big words, even if they're used correctly? But anyway, I understand that it's a complicated issue. I just wanted to say what I was feeling, and Mike and I talk about it a little at the end of our conversation. We don't necessarily agree on everything, but hey, like I said, it's a complicated issue. But anyway, something else we talk about in our conversation is about how a lot of people from our generation are pursuing creative things. And I was reading this Forbes article recently called How to Engage the Millennial Workforce, talking about how the corporate world has had to adapt to millennials' sensibilities. And some of the aspects that are talked about in the article, which I also talk about in my conversation with Mike, are how millennials are driven by having a sense of purpose and by collaboration in their endeavors. And obviously, that is synonymous with creative work. Trying to do something that transcends what is usually thought of as achievable. Obviously, there's other outlets where that can be accomplished too, you know, with startups and other stuff. But I talk about in my conversation with Mike about how I think the reason why our generation yearns for that type of work is because of this sense of optimism that was instilled in us by our parents, that we can be anything we want to be. Obviously, not everyone who's my age or around my age had parents who were like that, but it is a stereotype that is synonymous with our generation. And another stereotype for our generation is that a lot of times that idea of optimism is partnered with a laziness, because everything was handed to us and there's so many outlets of technology to be distracted by. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that stereotype, and if our generation can overcome that, I guess, remains to be seen. But anyway, I always wonder if that sense of optimism has legitimacy, and that I should truly believe that I can accomplish what I want most. And the reason I think I can, and the reason why I think our generation can overcome the stereotype that we're lazy, is because I feel as if we're passionate about something, we will work to get it, because we want that sense of purpose and do something that has worth. So I was glad to talk to another millennial who is pursuing something creative and is passionate about it, and I know that I need to at least try to pursue what I'm pursuing, because I know that if I wouldn't, I would hate myself if I didn't at least try. So if there's anyone listening who is afraid to go after what they truly want out of fear, gotta at least try. Anyway, here is my conversation with Mike Mee.
Oh, this is nice.
Yeah, right?
Oh, I love this setup.
This is my new room. It's actually
Wow. The
first one.
This is great.
Yep, that is the Leo posters.
I love it, dude. Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Better Call Saul. Louis. Louis's my favorite.
Yeah?
Oh my god.
I don't watch much of him, I gotta say.
Oh yeah, you're missing out, bro.
All right, you ready to do this?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that's you.
Cool.
That's you. Just make sure you...
Are you rolling already?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
That's how I do
I remember that from
Oh, you listen to Girardi's, right? Yeah. Yeah, just make sure you get it up somewhat close. Right. You can pull it, make sure, you know.
This is nice, man.
Yeah, right?
How's that?
That's great.
Can you hear me?
Right? Yeah. Right. So how you doing?
I'm good.
I don't think I've seen you since...
Probably
high school.
Well, I saw you.
Yeah.
On the Quinnipiac.
The late night show.
It was great, dude.
Oh, thanks, man.
I gotta say, I loved it.
I really appreciate, you know, knowing that you are trying to do similar stuff as me, getting messages from you saying you liked it.
Yeah.
Meant a lot.
It was cool. And I think it takes a lot of balls to do it in front of a bunch of college kids.
Yeah,
right.
Because
they could be a tough crowd, I'm sure.
Yeah. It was, you know, off and on.
Yeah.
But, hey, we're here to talk about you, right? Yeah. You still got jet lag?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's horrible, man.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to curse on this?
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. This podcast, man.
It's fucking horrible. I've been, man, it's like every day 2 p.m. rolls around.
Yeah.
And I can't stay up. So if I pass out here, it's going to be why. It's not
just in the middle of conversation.
A stroke or anything.
Well, hopefully I'll try to be interesting enough to keep your attention.
No, yeah, this is great.
So wait, where were you?
So I went to Southeast Asia.
Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I went for about 5 weeks with my business partner and, you know, one of my best friends, Ken.
Yeah.
We went for 5 weeks and backpacked.
Five weeks?
Yeah. We backpacked Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
Yeah? So. I always thought backpacking, it's too dangerous to backpack now because of human trafficking and things and terrorism.
I mean, I'm more afraid of walking into Willowbrook Mall and getting shot than I am of traveling to foreign countries.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in the Middle East, Europe, and
yeah,
it's just people are nicer there than they are here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we have all these preconceived notions about, especially people in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Just other countries in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it safe? Is it safe?
Mm-hmm.
But we had a great time.
Yeah.
And backpacking is just a freeing experience.
Yeah.
You kind of have to learn to just, you know, you land in a spot and be like, all right, it's 7 at night and we need to find a place to sleep.
Oh my God.
And you just kind of walk into hostels and you figure it out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was the only reason you were there to just backpack and like,
yeah.
Or is there any business or is it all pleasure?
No, this was just for fun.
Wow.
We usually travel and shoot things sometimes, you know.
Shoot things?
Film things. I'm sorry.
Well,
like, I use the term shoot,
I should have known. I don't know why I didn't know that.
Yeah. And we usually
so what was some what you shoot? What you
You mean like where have I been?
No. Well, I mean while you were there, like what was it? Just like let's see what we can film while we're here. It was like kind of a no plan.
No, we put the cameras aside for once.
Oh
yeah,
it
was nice to travel and not having to lug around gear the whole time. But then there's times you see a beautiful landscape and you're like, son of a bitch,
I wish I had my camera.
I wish we had the camera. But I'm telling you like the iPhone 6 takes great pictures and videos.
What was that movie that was just made with all an iPhone that like was in
Yeah,
Cannes,
they
I
just
think.
Came out with one. The
it
whole
in
thing
Cannes,
was shot
I think
in
it did really well.
There's another one coming out. They're filming just with a backup camera from a car.
Jesus.
I read. So, they're really kind of pushing.
People are doing crazy things.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
That's why we're in this business to let our creative minds kind of just wander.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
What was, if you could like, I mean, I know this is an ambiguous question, but if you could, one memorable thing that happened there, like a story or anything that like just struck you as, wow.
It was just so different, the whole thing. Like, talk about a culture shock.
I had a friend in school who said he studied, during the summer maybe, he lived in China and he said it was a bad experience for him because the culture is just so different.
Yeah. It could go both ways, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people try to rip you off and stuff.
Oh wow!
Because they know you're a foreigner. But I really enjoyed Vietnam. I think it was probably my favorite place. But one memorable thing we did was we had 14 hours in Tokyo as a layover on the way back.
Okay.
And we basically had no money left.
Oh god!
And luckily, my friend Tyler, before we left, gave us a $100 bill and said, bring me back the 100 or a story. And so we had to use the 100. And kind of an interesting story, I guess. We saw this. Do you know Anthony Bourdain?
Yeah, he's a chef.
He went to this in one of his episodes of No Reservations.
Right.
He went to this place called Robot Restaurant in Tokyo. And it's this restaurant where you drink and eat and you watch this insane robot show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with floats meets Pokemon meets robots meets like Asian dancers. And it was just this wild thing. I'll show you a video when we're done here.
Cool.
But I mean, that was different.
Yeah, and, I bet.
A lot of, you know, got a drink for it.
He was in The Big Short. Did you see that yet?
I saw The Big Short.
Yeah, he was one of the people who broke the fourth wall and they explained.
Yeah, he was. You're right.
Yeah.
Now I remember.
It was so great.
Yeah.
Well, man, that's cool that you got to do that.
Yeah, it was great.
Glad to be back here, though, in the States?
Not really.
Yeah.
I actually thought after 5 weeks
I could not wait to
come back. Mm-hmm. But I just love to travel, man.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And work is a little slow right now. So I'm kind of, you know, didn't have much to do now that I got back.
Yeah.
You know, we figure it out.
Well, hey, man, you got a long life ahead of you. Maybe you'll got a lot more traveling to do.
Yeah, so. If only it was cheaper.
Yeah, that's true.
And that, I mean, Southeast Asia is one of the cheapest places you can travel.
Really? How much
beer
was round
is 60 cents.
How much was a round trip?
Our round trip only cost $640.
Oh, wow.
You know, we bought it last March way in advance, but that's, I don't even know if you could fly to California for that price.
Dude, I've been just looking up tickets for that because I'm trying to go visit my friend in LA. And
nice.
It's, especially this time of year, it's I think, the most more expensive because everyone's trying to get away because it's the winter.
Right.
So
I mean, that's why I did.
Yeah.
I didn't see one inch of snow.
I wasn't.
You know, I was gone.
Yeah,
for
what's
the
it like over there?
And, it's warm.
Yeah.
There were some cold cities, you know, up north in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Wear a sweatshirt and jeans, but beats the hell out of shoveling.
Yeah, that's true. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Shoveling here at my house is like a military operation.
Yeah. You have to move the cars too.
Yeah, yeah. Same. Move the cars, and you can't dust off the cars before you move them because then it makes more snow on the thing. And shoveling has a certain technique.
Yeah.
My dad and brother. I just stay inside because I just get yelled at.
Yeah.
But
I try to just sleep in if my dad doesn't wake me up.
But So you're obviously interested in filmmaking. I'm interested to know what started that interest. Was it the classes in high school, or were you doing it before then? Classes with Sim. Have you heard from Sim?
Yeah, we get together and we have drinks and
Sim was our high school.
Yeah, Mr. Sim was
TV and video production teacher.
Yeah, sorry, I don't want to cut.
No, 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 it's okay. I don't want to cut you off.
Let me know.
No, talk over me. You can talk more than me. They hear me enough.
Oh, they'll be sick of me after.
Yeah,
an
no,
hour.
No, no.
But Mr. Sim was our TV and media teacher in high school. And his class was introduced when I was a junior.
Really? It was all that late?
Yeah. And I'll never forget that day, man. I was so fucking happy.
Yeah.
He sat up there and told us what the class would be. And I was like, thank God they finally are looking at kids with film and TV and like creative passion.
Mm-hmm.
And but to answer your question, I remember always loving movies when I was younger. It all started with Adam Sandler. I loved Happy Gilmore was the first Adam Sandler movie I remember watching. And I started watching all his, started watching all the old James Bond movies. But the turning point for me that I realized, hey, I can maybe go into film was that movie Big Fat Liar with Frankie Muniz. With Paul Giamatti. And I saw that in theaters and remember saying to myself, wow, like this kid's an actor. I could be an actor. I could be in movies.
Yeah.
And I wanted to act.
Yeah.
That's how it all started. And so I started acting in plays and, you know, I emceed the talent shows in the middle school and at Pequannock. And junior year, one acts, you know, thanks to your mom.
Yeah.
I acted freshman year and sophomore year rolled around and everyone was like, nobody wants to direct it. So I said, you know what? maybe it's good for me to see what behind the scenes is like, you know? So I directed with another girl, Whitney, sophomore year. And I was, you know, I was like, wow, you know, this directing thing is pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did it junior and senior year. And if I recall correctly, we were the only class to ever win it 2 years in a row.
Yeah, we actually won junior and senior year too.
Did you?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So we were first and then we you did. Guys. Yeah. That's awesome. And like, I hate saying this because it sounds like I'm bragging, but I think I was the first director to win junior and senior year also. And I remember the director for the seniors hated my guts.
That's the same when thing I won happened as a to junior. Us. Same thing happened to us.
Yeah. But that's what really changed it for me was when I learned what behind the scenes was like, what it takes to be a director. And then Mr. Sim came in junior year as I was getting into the directing thing with the TV course. And I took his class again senior year. They let me take it as like special credits because I just, my entire life and still now, my mind strictly only works creatively.
Yeah.
So I never enjoyed school. You know, I don't like being forced to learn about history and math that I'm never going to use. I'm never going to use algebra. But, you know, so when they introduced that class with Mr. Sim, I was like, finally, they're catering for more creative people. And people that aren't creative, I don't think they get it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but, you know, at least for me, like, our minds work differently, in my opinion. We just don't see the world the same way accountants do or lawyers do or doctors do. Mm-hmm. You know, we see stories in different... Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain, but...
Do you think that was an innate thing you had, or was it like a... Because I don't know what it is for me, if it's... Something drew me to that type of work. I don't know if it was seeing movies and seeing television... If I just identified with wanting to do something like that and dreamt of a world that wasn't like the norm, or if do you think it was just something that was innately a part of you? Because I wonder that too. If it's like a genetic thing like that, like you're destined to be that.
You know, it's interesting.
Or if it's circumstance.
Because I didn't think about this until a couple of years ago when I was talking to my dad, so my dad's side of the family is pretty creative, and it all started with. My great grandma was an art teacher, you know, just drawing and painting. Her son became a very famous sculptor.
Right.
He has statues all around the U.S. He does a lot of sculptures about Vietnam and soldiers. And then my dad's cousin designs cars for a living. And then here I am, and my dad kind of brought it up and said, you know, I think you just have adapted to the new art. You know, film and TV is an art, but they didn't have that, you know, 56 years ago when my great grandma.
Well, it wasn't as prevalent.
Exactly.
It was here, but it wasn't as.
Right.
It's a crazy thing.
It wasn't
thing
something
now.
People really went to school for technology now. Yeah. Like you have such greater platforms to work with, like the internet and stuff. But so I think it was genetic. I think I got. Kind of that next generation of creativity and art, and it just happened to be film for me. I used to draw a lot, so art when I was younger, art was always in my life. But I just kind of learned about this film thing.
It's interesting you say that because I was thinking about that the other day. Is that people around our age, people of our generation, it seems there's more people pursuing that type of thing. That there's more out there that like everyone's trying to put a sketch on YouTube. Everyone's trying to try stand-up comedy. Everyone's shooting a movie because digital cameras are so inexpensive.
Right.
And I was wondering if that's a product of us coming up in a time where there is so much around us that like everyone is a fan of something. Everyone is inspired by one thing, whether it's a sketch, people who make sketches on YouTube, it's whatever, there's so many different outlets for creation now. Or if it's this, because I think our parents instilled in us this like sense of optimism and this sense of we the things that we want to pursue in life, there needs to be some sense of purpose. There needs to be this idea of, of doing something of worth. So like we don't align with the mundane type of work style that is usually associated with what people should do.
Yes.
And they're letting us do that. Like parents are more okay, like go after what you want.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have more tools available to us, like you said.
Yeah.
Equipment is cheaper now, you know, editing systems you can do right on your laptop, YouTube, things like that. But back to what you kind of just said, I think more people would be pursuing these creative avenues if it weren't for parents.
Yeah.
I mean, do you know how many people I meet that are so passionate about film, TV, music, art, but they major in communications or business or this. Things they're not interested in because they want that safety net.
Yep.
And I remember my dad was not very supportive about the film thing when I first started out. He hated it.
Yeah.
And so I remember starting to minor in business to say, you know what, it'll shut him up, it'll give me a safety net if the film thing doesn't work out. But then I took the business class and I was like, I fucking hate this.
Yeah.
This isn't me. And you really need to, I talk to my friends about this all the time, you need to do what you love, because your parents aren't going to be the ones 40 years from now sitting in a cubicle miserable with the choice they made. You have to do it. And I think our parents pressure us to get that 9-to-5 job with benefits, you know, that society deems normal. And I think some people almost look down when you say, I majored in film or I majored in music, because why? You know, what are you going to do with that, they say. That's one of the biggest things I heard. What are you going to do with that degree?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to make it work is what I'm going to do. If you want something, you will push to make it happen. And, you know, that's what I do. You know, I don't work 9-to-5 jobs ever. I work 16 to 18 hour days, long days on set, on my feet all day. But you do it in the hopes that you know it's going to work out because you're that passionate about what you love.
Yeah, definitely there was definitely still some kids at college I met who really wanted to be either theater majors or film majors, whose parents were tentative about this. So they were like PT majors or psychology majors, but they were like really, really wanted to do the other thing. So that's still there, that pressure for a safety net. And I guess to a degree it's illogical. Is that sense of optimism in doing whatever you want to do, is that like, should that be a legitimate thing? Even I've thought of that, but like, oh, dude, it would be awesome to just have like health insurance and to have and to have like a routine.
Of course.
I met this kid who helped my grandma walk. He lived in Vermont. He does production assistant work in Arizona or New Mexico. And he was telling me the story about how
he
had
work on Breaking Bad.
I don't think he did. But that'd be amazing. That's where that is.
I'm getting that contact.
Are you? Yeah.
Idol show, but I'm sorry, guys.
Hey, man, he's a contact of mine, which means he's a contact of yours now. I
appreciate that.
But yeah, so he's like, I think he had just shot some Imagine Dragons music video down there when I had recently talked to him. He does some cool stuff.
Yeah.
But he was talking about he had a root canal or something wrong with his tooth, and he couldn't afford it in America, so he went down to Mexico, and he told me this whole ridiculous story of like he had no idea what they were saying or how they were going to do the procedure and how he was scared and how he eventually ended up paying like $30 to get his tooth pulled. And I was like, I don't know if I could fucking do that. I was like, can I do that? Like, I completely immediately projected that onto what my future is going to be. So like there is a safety net, but like, I don't know. I feel like if you're passionate enough about it, you got to overcome that.
My favorite director is David Fincher.
Oh my God.
And he's just a twisted genius.
I got Social Network in
House
there.
House of Cards, you got up on the wall too.
I got Social Network on
now
Blu-ray.
I know what Girardi was talking about when he was like, wow, you got this on your wall and this. Yeah. I'm sitting here like, wow.
Yeah.
There Will Be Blood. Like, that's a great film.
Oh my God.
But David Fincher is like my idol director. I love his work. And you know, Social Network is one of my favorite movies by far. But he said when he was younger, He said to his parents, I'm going to go into film and TV. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, how are you going to do that? He said, I'm going to start by making shitty commercials.
Yeah.
And doing, you know, crappy film shoots. And then I'm going to direct movies someday.
Yeah.
And they said, what happens if what are you going to do if it doesn't work out? And he said, it's going to work out. There's no other option. And I think that's the mentality you have to put in your head is that mm-hmm. there is no plan B.
Yeah, plan B is toxic.
You kind of, plan B is your safety way out, in my opinion.
Because it's always there. You're always like, I could do that if it is. So it kind of like, maybe it doesn't propel you as much to do what you actually want.
If film doesn't work out, I'll go into this. So I try to block out the if it doesn't. It's like, it'll work. Mm-hmm. And it's worked so far. It's difficult. But it works. You know, I was living in Brooklyn for a little while. I live in the city with a great friend of mine when I have to do long days on set, you know, working on movies and TV shows. And it's a lot of traveling back and forth. But you do make it work. And if you love it, you just put up with those shitty circumstances.
Yeah. Fincher, man, he was someone who... He started out music videos too, right?
Yeah, he did commercials, music videos, you know, infomercials, things like that. And he's a genius.
Yeah, he does like a lot of wide shots because he does multiple takes, right? I think on Social Network there was one, the opening scene, he did 99 takes or something
was
like
it?
That. Yeah.
I mean, it's a great scene
because
it's so dialogue heavy too.
Yeah.
I mean,
I heard like in an interview, Mark Ruffalo said that. You realize he's not even thinking of you. He's thinking of everything. So he'll like come up to you, be a cut. He'll come up to you, move you over an inch, move a mug over like an inch.
Yes.
He's thinking of the
he's
whole thing.
Very
meticulous.
Yes. And I mean, I'm like that too when when I shoot my own stuff. And you're a perfectionist kind of like, because if you walk away with that shot and you get into the editing studio, you're like, shit, why didn't you move that? Like now you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
So you're kind of better off doing it 99 times, getting it the way you want, rather than going back and reshooting it. You know, but I love Fincher because he loves doing films about the people's like mental state. And he loves that twisted mind. And, you know, he does a lot of panning, shots on faces and things like that, and I love that. Like, I'm all about the emotional responses that the faces give when I film things.
Dude, being director, like, it's such a daunting. It would be so, like, undertaking. You really need to know everyone's job, like just as much as they do.
You really do.
Remember I heard a thing Ben Affleck on Gone Girl. He tested David Fincher. He like changed the focus of the camera just a little bit to see if he would notice.
Yeah.
And David Fincher like came. He's like, why does this camera look a little dim? Like, he just knew right away.
Still
just,
Ben Affleck.
Yeah. But it's crazy.
But yeah. Like, I mean, you have to have an eye for everything when you're directing. And
you have to be this morale leader too. You kind of have to be a lead. Like, you have to.
You know what's interesting? I worked on a Showtime series called Happy-ish last year.
Yeah, with the English guy, right?
Steve Coogan and Catherine Hahn. And
got canceled, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I loved the show. It was so darkly funny and twisted, but, you know, it just, people weren't watching it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I had a friend who was in that.
Only got one season. Oh, yeah?
Pete Brenzinger. He had a small role.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He's from Pops and Lakes. Someone else had told me that. He's the one with the long hair.
Yeah.
I actually sat down and talked to him that day.
Really?
When he was on set, but I didn't know who he was at the time.
His mom, Miss Brenzinger, teaches at the high school. Yeah. I did some plays with him when I was a kid.
Nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, so when I worked on that show, I was the assistant for a producer and director named Ken Kwapis, who's had a big role, you know, in The Office, Malcolm in the Middle, and he's directed films like He's Just Not That Into You and Dunstan Checks In, which was one of my favorites growing up.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a great director because he had so much respect on set because he was so nice to people. Like, he goes up to anyone on set, a PA, the woman cooking the food and says, "Hi, I'm Ken. What's your name?" Mm-hmm. And talks to them, you know? And the best advice that he gave me that I walked away with was directing isn't about being in charge of the crew. It's about being a part of the crew.
Right.
And he really lives by that. Like, he really is friendly to them and hangs out with them and is respectful to them. And even when he's directing on set, he doesn't sit at the monitor. He sits next to the camera operator,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's really up close with the actors and the camera guys.
Yeah, he's like a part of it.
And that's, I feel like I do that when I shoot my own stuff. And it just kind of, you know, was a good feeling to know that, like, you know, maybe I'm doing this right.
Mm-hmm.
He does it this way, and he's, you know, very successful with the people he works with. And, you know, hopefully I'm on the right track.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Yeah, man. Oh, I want to hear some about those projects you have done. So did you, what was college like for you? Where'd you go to college?
Montclair.
Montclair? Yeah. What was the film program like there?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you know, it's funny. Let me back up. I actually dropped the film program and went into the TV program.
Oh, wow.
The broadcasting program.
Oh.
The film, some of the film kids were very pompous.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that about everybody, but mm-hmm. I just had one really bad experience with this kid who kind of gave me a lot of shit for something I wrote. You know, we had to write a script. And I was very passionate about it. And I usually don't care at all what people think about me or my ideas. But then he presented something, and his idea was the worst thing I ever heard. And I walked out of the class.
Yeah.
And I never went back. And
wow.
I switched to the broadcasting program.
Wow.
And I was like, I will not spend the next 2 years with kids
in that
like
environment,
that
yeah.
who think their shit doesn't stink. I mean, if you wanna take a crap on my work, that's fine. But yeah. you better bring something better to the table.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to deal with people like that. And it was the best decision I ever made because I met some great mentors in the broadcasting department. Steve McCarthy is one of them. He's worked for Dateline and 60 Minutes his whole career, traveled the world.
Wow.
And he's just a great guy who I look up to now and I'm still very close with. And there were just so many opportunities, field trips to ABC and NBC. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how I got my first job in the industry. I did an internship with NBC.
Oh, yeah. What was that like? Was it just the page?
Oh, it was great. No, I worked at the NBC in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And my job, I interned and then they hired me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were like, at the end of my internship, they're like, you know, hit us up in 2 years when you graduate. Mm-hmm. I was a sophomore still. And I'm like, well, why don't you just hire me part-time now? Like,
yeah.
I would love to work. And they did.
So you worked for them throughout college?
Yeah. So the rest of my sophomore year, junior and senior year, I'd go to school from like 8:30 to 3:30 and then work like 6 to 11 at night, you
wow.
know, or 5 to midnight sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great job, great people. And that's kind of how my network for NBC grew, how I started working on set and working in other departments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like just this past year, I started working a lot with the live events unit. So I worked the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade,
oh, wow.
the Rockefeller Tree Lighting, and New Year's Eve.
Were you just like a PA?
Yeah,
or you
PA, you? And yeah. I director's assistant.
Oh, interesting.
So assisting director, which is what I love to do.
Yeah.
That's where I learn the most.
Yeah.
PAing can get very mentally exhausting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really are kind of the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, doing bitch work.
Yeah, but if the people are nice, it's fine.
Yeah,
it really is about the people you work for. If they treat you with respect, you have no problem getting coffee for somebody.
Yeah,
absolutely not. But if they're just downright disrespectful and rude to you, it makes the job very difficult to mentally
mm-hmm.
get through. And so PAing is mentally and physically exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do 12 to 18 hour days and sometimes just doing bitch work.
Yeah.
But it's all about meeting people. It really is.
Yeah.
And that's how you kind of just, for every, you know, new TV show or feature I work on, I meet five new people.
Right.
So it's like, if I get a call saying, I'll get a call the night before sometimes, hey, you available to work on Ninja Turtles 2? You know, got to be in at 6 a.m. in Manhattan. I do it because I know I'll walk away with six new phone numbers that day.
Right.
You know, and that's what it's about. You always keep in touch with these people. And if they can't do a job, they'll recommend you. Mm-hmm. And that's just how it goes. It really is who you know, as cliche as that expression is.
Yeah, a good piece of advice I heard was say yes to everything.
Yeah.
Because you never know what it's going to lead to.
It's true. And no job is small enough. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have the chance to get coffee for David Fincher, you're gonna make that cup of coffee and you're gonna bring it to him. I mean, because you never know what it's gonna lead to,
yeah,
who you're gonna meet. Mm-hmm. And you just can't go around thinking these jobs are too little for you, because mm-hmm. unfortunately, it's a business where if you don't want to be in it, then get the hell out. Mm-hmm. Because there is somebody else who will gladly get that cup of coffee that mm-hmm. you don't want to do.
Right.
You know, if you complain, you could be sure you probably won't work much again, because your name will be passed around mm-hmm. like that. And you just, you know, you do it because, like I said, you have to have faith it will lead to better things.
Right.
A camera guy I met once at NBC had really good advice. He said, there's going to be 2 days in this industry. The days where you wake up and say, I don't get paid enough to do this shit.
Yeah.
And the days you wake up and say, I can't believe I get paid to do this shit. You know, and that's how it is. There's days I've been miserable and mm-hmm. thought about quitting the industry. Mm-hmm. And then there's days where I say, you know, wow, I get to hang out with Robert De Niro for a couple hours.
Did that happen?
Why not? Yeah.
What?
Just once, like
when?
Very briefly.
What
on
movie?
On a show, Wizard of Lies.
Oh, I think of...
He's playing Bernie Madoff.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. It's a,
they
it's
may
a,
not talk much, but it's like, yeah, I get
he
to
doesn't
hang
talk
out
much at
and,
all.
And hang out
very
with these actors.
Shy
and happy,
person.
Like, happy-ish. I got to hang out with Coogan and Catherine Hahn every day and talk to them and, you know, eat lunch with them and hear their stories. And
that Madoff thing, a miniseries? What was it for?
I think it's an HBO film.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. So it's like you have the rewarding days and you have the days where you're like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And those days happen a lot, but...
It's because it's for people who have to do it, it's like the money doesn't really mean anything. I remember listening to an interview with Judd Apatow where he was talking, who I talk about a lot on this podcast.
He's great.
Seems. Yeah. He was talking about how I would still be doing this if I got paid $30,000 a year, and we would just have to be living in a shitty apartment, me and my family. But it just so happens that I have hit this weird jackpot, and the thing that I love to do pays well. But obviously that's not for everyone.
Well,
but he said he would be doing it regardless of...
Yeah.
Because he has to do it.
And it's the business is interesting in that regard, because when you start off at the bottom, like, you are at the bottom.
Yeah.
You are the shit underneath a shoe. And then when you're Judd Apatow and David Fincher and, you know, Vince Gilligan, you are getting paid ridiculous amounts of money to mm-hmm. do what you love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we work so hard, because we know there will be a day where our time comes and, you know, we will get paid well to do what we love.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right now we get paid scraps, but
speaking of work so hard, do you have problems with laziness? Do you have problems with like procrastination? I was reading this book up there called The War of Art. It'd be interesting. Nice. You should read it. It's about kind of overcoming the obstacles that kind of what blocks you from fulfilling your full creative potential. And like the first third of it that I'm reading is about it's about what gets in the way, resistance. That's what it's about.
Uh-huh.
And it's about anything, procrastination, anything that like, it's this kind of unrecognizable, invisible thing that just doesn't make you do what you should be doing. Whether
right.
it's procrastination, whether it's watching too much TV,
yeah.
whether it's masturbation, whether like that's the examples they use.
We're all guilty of
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And creative people are usually like kind of lazy. Do you ever have issues with like
yeah
getting the first foot
absolutely
forward, and how do you overcome that if you do?
I write a lot. I'm actually working on my own TV show and,
oh, yeah.
and films. So my dream is to be Vince Gilligan.
Yeah.
Like I want to be it's called a
showrunner.
Yeah, somebody who runs the show. And hey, if you didn't get that by the name, he writes, produces, directs.
Yeah. And the showrunner, the head writer is the god of TV world, where the director is the god of movie world.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So writing is where I feel I have the most trouble with not procrastinating.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah, dude.
To get yourself to sit down, and when you come to those roadblocks that writers
starting come the to, process.
Yeah. Just... You have to sometimes you have to step away and procrastinate to go back and mm-hmm. make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely run into that a lot. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I watch Breaking Bad over and over and over.
Yeah, I've watched it like 3 or 4 times.
Because that's what keeps me to keep moving.
That's why I have these posters up.
Exactly.
It's like, okay, inspiration.
Yeah. And you know what else I actually have in my room is, you know, I have like a picture of Leo, mm-hmm. obviously.
You better fucking
Jimmy Fallon with the Tonight Show. Like things like that. Yeah, exactly. But I have all the film festivals that denied my films.
Wow.
I printed the emails and I hung them up. And for me, that is my...
That's dope.
That's what pushes me because mm-hmm. Sandra Bullock, I guess it was like 2009 or something, she won Best Actress for The Blind Side.
Yep.
And she said the typical never let anyone tell you you can't do something spiel.
Yeah.
But I disagree. Like, I love when people tell me I can't do something because it pushes me harder mm-hmm. and further. And I take that negative energy and I transform it to, you know.
Motivation.
Yeah, as motivation. And that's just what works for me. I mean, different things work for different people.
I remember I heard an interview about how Jerry Seinfeld, when he wrote Seinfeld, had a picture of the Hubble telescope in the writer's room to remind him how irrelevant everything is and to not take it so seriously. Meaning he's just like a speck in this space and to not be so stressed about it and just do the work.
And as a writer, that's important because mm-hmm. the thing that holds me back sometimes is I say, well, I work so hard on writing this TV show. Like I'm on episode 4 now.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken me 2 years to get to that point. And I always say like, what if this never goes anywhere? And it's highly possible it won't. I mean, TV shows, thousands are written and pitched and don't get picked up.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remind yourself, like, you know, you can't listen to all that negativity. Yeah. And that's probably what Jerry meant by, like, you know, it's not that important and big. Like, just do it and you'll worry about where it goes afterwards.
Yes.
And I think that's important as mm-hmm. as a writer.
So I'm interested in what other projects during college or after college did you work on, and how was the post-college for you? We talk about that a lot. How was like the change in that type of, you got used to a certain routine. How was the, okay, everything's left up for me. Now I have to kind of go at this.
Well, like I said before, I never liked school.
Yeah.
And I hated college more than I hated any other school.
Yeah.
I think college is strictly a business. And if you didn't have to go through the first 2 years of gen eds again,
mm-hmm.
I'd be like, you know what? I get college. I can major in what I love and learn what I love.
Mm-hmm.
Great. But I had like a 2.3 GPA throughout college until I hit the broadcasting program.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hit the dean's list every semester. So it just shows that like you need to love what you're studying to try and care and mm-hmm. do well. So I, you know, eventually I did like the broadcasting department, but I was always over school, and I was so happy when I graduated because I've always wanted to work. You know, I got my first job when I was 12 picking up dog shit in a grooming place. I've always wanted to work. That was me.
You literally started at the bottom.
Literally.
Started with the shit on the shoe.
Man. I literally. So I just always wanted to work, and I couldn't wait to be done with school.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the time, for all this to make sense, the job I had at NBC when I was working throughout school,
mm-hmm.
my job was literally to kind of watch TV all day and look for cursing, nudity, audio levels, make sure the rating was correct. Like, we had to quality control all the NBC programs to make sure they were good to go on air.
Oh, right.
And it was like, it was a great job. I worked with great people. But for me, it killed me to have to watch TV all day when I want to be out there making TV.
Right.
So for me, it was creatively numbing, you know, yeah, everything I had. So when the time came when I graduated, you know, they offered me full-time position doing that over and over. And I wanted to take it, but I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't let myself settle for something that I wouldn't enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started kind of meeting people, emailing people saying, look, I want to work on set. Like, what do I have to do? You know, who do I have to meet? And then I started on set with CNBC, you know, and then live events with NBC. And then I started working in features and scripted TV, working on, you know, TV shows, you know,
yeah,
and movies.
Yeah.
So for me, post-college has been the best time of my life because college made me feel so restricted,
mm-hmm,
and forcing me to learn stuff I didn't really care about. And mm-hmm, I just always wanted to work. So I've loved it. I mean, post-college for me, it's fucking great.
Open road.
It's great, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn 21, I could party, I could work. I'm an adult, mm-hmm, and I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I never liked being treated as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, post-college has been great. I mean, it's tough to find work, obviously,
mm-hmm,
but, you know, on my spare time, I write. I produce my own films. You know, that's what I'm doing now.
So you have your own production company? Is that what the business you were talking about?
My friend Ken does, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like the co-founder.
Yeah.
I kind of have helped him try to build it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a blast. It's a lot of fun. We produce documentaries, music mm-hmm videos, commercials, corporate videos.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we're producing a documentary called Epidemic H
mm-hmm
about the heroin epidemic in New Jersey. And it's great. Like, we're directing and producing it. And
you're co-directing it?
Yeah.
So what has been the process of that? I'm interested in to hear about how it started.
For me, it started with my dad. He, you know, I love my dad, and he, mm-hmm, his way of kind of always trying to teach us a lesson, quote unquote, would be like, oh, the town just got, you know, $20,000 more for checkpoint stops for drunk driving. Be careful. That's his way of saying
yeah,
don't drink and drive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, another person crashed and died on 23, drunk driving.
Yeah.
You know,
one day my dad works for car insurance. One day he said, come down here, Joe. He just shows me a picture of a destroyed car. He's like, this guy was drinking.
Exactly.
Like, all right, Dad.
They did that at Pequannock.
I don't even really drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I tried to get this guy to have some beers with me.
Yeah, sorry, man.
Sorry. So my dad one day dropped a newspaper on the table and was like, another one dead from heroin.
Yeah.
And I was with Ken at the time and we were like,
that might be a thing.
This could be our next film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for Ken, I know he had friends that he lost from heroin overdoses. And for me, I can't say I was friends with many people that have overdosed.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's good because
you have distance.
I get to produce this film from an outsider's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I like to do it. I like to, when I do a documentary, I like to know as little as I can about the subjects and the people I interview, because then the interview becomes real at that point. And it's me curiously asking questions because I need to find the truth behind this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of good that I didn't know much about this heroin thing. You know, I didn't even know what heroin looked like before the film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that maybe that's just me. I don't, you know, but
the only reason I do is because of Pulp Fiction.
True. Okay, I've seen movies, heroin.
Yeah.
You're right. It's been, the process is very difficult.
Yeah. So what have you, from the outside perspective, what have you learned now about the whole, I know it's a kind of a dark topic,
that,
but what has been interesting that you've?
Like, we've interviewed so many addicts and family members and cops, and I think what I've learned is this really affects more people than any of us could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
When we first started this film, we were reaching out to people on Facebook, sending messages like, do you want to be a part of our film? I hear your son's an addict. Once the film started getting momentum and people were hearing about it, people were reaching out to us. Messages on Facebook messages, you know, hey, my son's a user. Hi, I'm a ex-heroin addict, you know, this and that. And I was like, wow, you know, kids I graduated high school with in town, their mother's reaching out to me saying, my one son is a user.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I never knew that. I sat next to a kid in math class.
Jeez.
You know? Yeah. And the moment it kind of became real for me was we interviewed a heroin addict in a hotel room. And it was a crazy interview. Like, looking, he just shot up 20 minutes before we got in the hotel room.
Jesus, he was high?
And he was high during it. And
how the fuck did he let you do that?
Because he was high. He wouldn't have done the interview if he wasn't. But that was a moment I realized, like, this film is real, you know? And it really is going to be a life-changing film. The stories we have, the people we've interviewed.
What was he like? Was he nodding off? Was he
By
was
the he time attentive? He was sobering up, he was getting frustrated with the questions I asked.
Yeah.
And, you know, then he said, you know, I'm done with this. So we had about a 45-minute window until he sobered up.
Wow.
And it's just, these people are, it's an honor that they let us into their lives like this to tell their story and trust us enough to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories we've heard are just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a family of seven, five are addicts. You just don't hear that every day.
That's crazy.
And Epidemic H, we really believe is going to make waves across the country.
So what's the plans with it now? But what stage are you at?
The plan right now is we need more funding.
Yeah.
You know, we were funded.
Kickstarter?
Yeah. So if I could drop just a little promotion here, like,
yeah,
we need some more funding to tell this story and just to get us through the editing stages. We're almost done filming.
Preparation.
You're not the first to do that.
Epidemic H.
We have a Facebook page.
Right.
You can go to www.gofundme.com/epidemicH.
Yep.
And just liking and sharing our Facebook page helps a lot. Mm-hmm. The more people that know about this issue in this film, the more people it's going to help, you know? And I think also, to answer your question, the thing I learned about the film was the stigma behind heroin.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't want to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
or they're ashamed to say, oh, how's Timmy doing? Timmy's great. He's in school. How's Johnny? They're ashamed to say Johnny's a heroin addict, and it shouldn't be that way. You know, this heroin addiction, it's kind of like a disease, and it needs to be brought up like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that these people are real people and humans with stories and feelings, and you know, people need to just face that and talk about it, and they need to teach this stuff in schools.
Yeah.
Kids are starting
to do a little in health class, but about drugs and stuff.
Start telling them in seventh grade.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
with DARE, they do kind of, but
yeah.
Have you ever heard of Harris Whittles, the comedy writer? He wrote for Parks and Rec. He helped write for Aziz Ansari's new show. He was a comedy writer who died a little more than a year ago from heroin overdose.
Wow.
And he told the story about how he got addicted to heroin on Pete Holmes's podcast, You Made It Weird.
Oh, yeah?
And how it started off with just casually doing OxyContin. And then it got to the point where he was so addicted to OxyContin that when he didn't take it, he got sick. And he couldn't afford it anymore because it was so expensive.
And then he switched to heroin.
Yeah. Started snorting it at first. And then it fucked up his nose. So then he started shooting it. And it just like that, it takes you like that. Wow, now I'm shooting heroin. That was what his words were.
Yeah. A lot of the stories I've heard start with pills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get a freshman in high school gets injured in football, and the doctor prescribes him pills, not really mm-hmm. considering how much he's giving them. And then 2 months later, the kid's doing heroin. And
yeah, dude. High school kids now are doing freaking Percocets. Yeah. That's what they're crushing up Percocets in the bathroom. And yeah.
Even, you know, it's like, yeah. And these kids get it from their parents' medicine cabinet, yeah. too. It's, you just, the other thing is like, parents need to know, like, parents can't go out there and say, my kid's perfect. It's never going to happen to them.
Right.
Because, okay, if it doesn't happen to your friend, I mean, your kid, mm-hmm. your kid's friend may. And then they who introduces influence. Your kid to right. heroin? Their best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And parents just need to be a little less naive and right. wake up and realize it could be their kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I first started the film, I pictured heroin addict, a guy in an alley,
right.
with no shoes shooting up. But no,
it's
a kid like that looks like you and me,
mm-hmm.
from a nice home with great parents, mm-hmm. with anything he could want. And it could be the person next door, your sister down the hallway. Like, people just need to realize it really could happen to anybody, and
yeah.
just got to be more alert and talk about it. But the support for the film would be great, because
yeah, man, it's cool you're doing
very
that.
Confident.
Make sure you look up Epidemic H, not Preparation H.
Yeah, please don't.
But if you that. Need that as well, yeah. go to CVS.
Go to yeah. yeah, we're not gonna stop you from yeah. getting Preparation H.
We don't want to, yeah.
But Epidemic H is
yeah,
is key.
Well, man, that's awesome you're doing it. So what else you have? What else? We usually end with a hopes for the future thing. What?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Personal, professional, you just want to keep climbing up this film ladder and eventually start making your own stuff? And what?
Yeah.
What do you foresee?
I mean, for now, like, getting this film done soon would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really have a lot of confidence that it can go places, you know, film festivals. It has the ability to be on Netflix. Like, it just looks amazing, and the stories are great.
Watch the trailer. It looks nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. And that's just like a small teaser.
Yeah, yeah,
We're
yeah.
going to release something in a couple months, you know, a real trailer. But
what percentage, like, shooting-wise, how much do you think you have done? How much?
75% about.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of more or less about following the rest of these people's stories.
Right.
You know, you don't just shoot, you know, these people for a week and then
needs
say,
an
oh, we got them, we're done. It needs an ending, exactly. And unfortunately with addicts,
there might not be an ending.
There might not be, or there
or
will be a bad
be
ending. Whether it's death, jail,
mm-hmm.
I mean, or they get clean, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
So finishing this film really is my next goal. Mm-hmm. I would just love to keep traveling and filming and telling stories, and then the dream somewhere down the line would be to be Vince Gilligan, David Fincher, and, you know, Martin Scorsese. I just love directing, and I love films and the world that films take you to.
Mm-hmm.
Or films help you relate, you know, to things going on in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love them. They bring me out of my realm into another world.
And they
making
just
them.
Create joy.
Yeah.
Joyous
or death or sadness, whatever yeah. kind of films you like.
Yeah.
but you know, tonight is the Oscars.
Yeah, man. I was gonna ask you who you got. Who you picking? This Best Picture race this year is interesting because usually it's like between two with like a probable front runner. And this year, I've been looking yeah. at odds and stuff. It's between The Revenant, Big Short, and Spotlight. They kind of split the guilds.
Yeah.
Revenant maybe has a slight advantage because it made so much money. And it's got 12
have you
nominations.
Seen them, most of the
I've seen all
Oscar
of the best
picks?
Pictures.
Yeah, me too. What did you like the best?
That's interesting because I thought Spotlight was just a great no bullshit movie. Told the story perfectly. Didn't harp on any cliche like they could have harped on like the negative aspects of the priests and all that and kind of made it a little too sappy. But I thought they did a good job of just deriving the information and telling you what you needed to know about the characters. But The Revenant was just this, like this movie like I've never seen before. It was like Emmanuel Lubezki's yeah. shot. It's just beautiful. It felt yeah. like I was there. It was so immersive. It felt like I was someone there watching it all happen.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It was cinematically like
yeah.
beautiful.
And then Big Short was Those are definitely my favorite three of the year.
But I actually know the editors on Spotlight.
Oh yeah?
I was working on a Robert Redford film called A Walk in the Woods that came out last year.
Oh, I heard about that, yeah.
And we were editing in the same facility Spotlight was being edited in.
Oh, wow.
And I remember having lunch with the editors and my friend Amanda, who was working on the film at the time, and they were like, this is going to be a solid film.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, the guy is up for an editing Oscar, like the guy I had lunch with every day.
That's crazy.
But Spotlight, it was well done. But I just kind of needed more of some kind of payoff or twist, I guess you could say, at the end. I think it was very well done.
It was leading to a place that we saw coming. Kind of.
I mean, you knew it was going to, you know.
Yeah.
I like endings that slap you in the face.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen. The Big Short, it was good. I just couldn't get past Adam McKay's directing.
You thought it was too jumpy all over the place, too sloppy?
I couldn't do it, man. I thought I was having a seizure while I was watching it.
Yeah.
It was just definitely shots purposely out of focus.
Individualistic
and not
style.
Focusing on a coffee mug when I would want to see the guy's face because he's saying something very important.
Right.
However, it was very well written.
Yeah.
Christian Bale was amazing.
Yeah, the performance was great.
But for me, my favorite was absolutely The Revenant.
Yeah.
Everything about it was well done.
Mm-hmm.
Leo's my man. Might be a little biased, but I really think it was a beautiful move, well shot and directed and the scoring.
Mm-hmm.
But did you see Room?
Yes.
Also a great film.
Yeah,
Room was an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah.
And she's going to win Best Actress.
She's going to win, yeah.
The directing in that was great.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, my favorites were probably The Revenant and Room for me.
Yeah.
So I think Revenant's going to take Best Picture, Best Actor, and I think Brie Larson is going to get Best Actor. Yeah, and it'll get Best
Manuel Director. Lubezki is going to win probably cinematography. He's going to make history. Would be his third win in a row because he won last year for Birdman and the year before that for Gravity.
Birdman was great.
Oh, my God. I got it down there.
It was so cool, man.
So awesome. Love that.
But I'm excited, man.
I'm excited to hear Chris Rock tackle this whole...
I don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm so annoyed with that BS they're pulling. But,
yeah. Did you hear... my last podcast, I talked about it.
Did you?
Yeah.
I'll have to listen.
I just talked about how it's a systemic problem that is not the Oscars' fault and that just it's going to take time to fix.
Yeah. But it's like, I wouldn't even watch, I don't think, this year if Leo wasn't up.
Yeah.
I don't like Chris Rock to begin with.
You don't?
He's racist as always, and now it's just going to be his glorified platform to be more racist.
I don't know if he's racist. You think he's racist? What?
Dude, even in Madagascar, he has to drop am I black or white? Am I black with white stripes or white with black stripes? Like, everything he does.
That's racist, man.
It's cracker this, and yeah.
Well, he talks about race, but I think he does it in a classy way. But hey, man, I agree to disagree.
Yeah,
I disagree there,
but I'm not gonna let it.
There is a problem.
Ruin my night.
There is a problem. It's not necessarily the Academy's problem, but there is a problem in Hollywood with diversity. There definitely is.
Yeah, but the way I see it, like you look at all the films this year, a lot of them were based on true stories.
Right.
This is how I see it. So what are you gonna do? Fabricate the color of actor's skin?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is something something I didn't
diversity.
Talk about in. In my podcast was this idea of whitewashing, where there's movies that are meant for actors of color that are given to white people. Like Exodus was given to Christian Bale. It was about an Egyptian.
Oh, yeah.
Moses was Egyptian. Like Prince of Persia. They did a thing on John Oliver about that. Prince of Persia, like Jake Gyllenhaal. He's not Persian. He's white.
Uh-huh.
And that's been happening forever. Gandhi, Ben Kingsley played him. He's white. So I think there's this weird...
Yeah, but I think that's about
it's about...
Some actors can... Some good actors can pull off different ethnicities.
And it's
like
about
Johnny
we need
Depp
the biggest name.
Johnny Depp can pull off.
That was
so
another
many
one.
Different...
He played the Native American. It's about we need the name of the best actor to get people to come to it.
Yeah.
No one's gonna.
Why
come...
does anyone see certain movies?
Well, for people like me and you, I would rather. I think kind of. I have this sometimes these thoughts of like movie stars kind of like defy the idea of actual art because it's like, oh, Seth Rogen's playing another guy named Jeff. Who's just the same. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I would rather see two Egyptians who I don't know in a movie about Moses. But, like, I understand that you need Christian Bale to bring in the people.
Yeah.
It's, so it's this weird...
I mean, at the end of the day, it sucks, but it is a business.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to make the best business move to bring people in. Like, I mean, me and my friends were just talking about this last night. I hate the superhero movies, the comic book movies.
Dude.
I don't go see them. They're just strictly money makers.
Guardians of the Galaxy was great, man.
I won't even say it.
Oh,
but
so
I am going to see Batman versus Superman.
You're not going to see Civil War?
Because Jesse Eisenberg is playing a villain.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to drag me to go see this movie that I probably would never see otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Each his own.
Yeah.
You know?
So I guess you like the comic book movies.
Well, I don't hate them. I think some of them are derivative and like kind of just popcorn, like,
yeah,
consumer based trying to, but I think some of them have substance. I think Guardians of the Galaxy was kind of like,
I heard it was good.
It was great. It had humor.
But even people ask me like, oh, you didn't like
it was
the
shot
Avengers?
Beautifully.
Oh, I mean, the Avengers was just still superhero saves the day. To me, there's no substance behind it. But maybe that's...
I've heard people call them Shakespearean because there's there's like there's the action and then there's the comedy and then there's the...
I get it. I mean, they're like... I loved the Dark Knight films. I love the Spider-Mans. I think, you know, they're fun. They're funny.
Mm-hmm.
They're good movies. But when you release 9 superhero movies a year, I have no desire
it's definitely
to see
oversaturated.
Any of them.
Definitely oversaturated. But it's a phase. It's not going to happen forever. I don't think so,
Not. Because maybe that's just me as a filmmaker. Like, I love movies with a good substance and story and drama, like real life.
Mm-hmm.
I love films based on true stories. I mean, Goodfellas, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, Gangs of New York, Catch Me If You Can. They're all part of, you know, some of my favorite films.
Mm-hmm.
Or even Titanic, where you take two fake people, but put them in a real life
historical
world
fiction
that took place.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of stuff, but that's just me.
I mean, man.
That's the kind of stuff I enjoy, and people like superhero stuff.
Well, thanks, man. I hope people enjoy this.
Me too.
I appreciate you doing it.
Hope I'm not boring.
No, you aren't.
Oh,
you aren't.
These are. Oh, you got mugs.
Stav got them for me. Yeah,
that millennial. I love that.
Yeah,
well, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, you could just buy mugs with put anything on them. Apparently, on the internet.
That thing called the internet.
The internet has everything.
Has the ability to do that, huh?
Well, I appreciate it. Good luck with all your future endeavors. I hope
we keep
in touch.
Yeah.
I'll let you know when this comes out.
I'm excited, man. It was
all
good
to
be here.
Appreciate it. All right, that is it. Thank you to Mike Mee. Appreciate you coming on, letting me nerd out with you about movies. Really enjoyed it a lot. And thank you for talking about all the creative work you're doing. Hopefully you will inspire other young people to go after their creative dreams or any other dreams that they have. Thank you to everyone who's listened. Please, if you have not left a review or rated the podcast on iTunes, do so. If you enjoy the podcast, share it on Facebook with your friends. Tell people about it. I'm trying to make people, as many people, listen to this as possible because I want to keep doing it. Should be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening, guys. Have a good week. Leo won, right? I hope so. All right, bye.